If you're gay, then you're gay. Don't pretend that you're straight. You could be who you are any day of the week. You are unlike the others, so strong and unique. We're all with you.
If you're straight, well, that's great. You can help procreate and make gay little babies for the whole human race. Make a world we can live in where the one who you love's not an issue.
Thanks for tuning in, and welcome to the April 27th, 2020 shelter-in-place edition of IMRU Radio Magazine. Hello, I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Tonight, we celebrate what would have been the 87th birthday, on April 29th, of poet and songwriter Rod McEwen, with a visit to his 67th birthday party in 2001. And we party down with the muscular fiddlers of Wellstrung to get their origin story, and we vogue with the talented singers and dancers from Madonna's Blonde Ambition Tour. And we'll take a much-needed comedy break with the Nellie Olsons. But first, some honest tea. From LGBTQNation.com, Friday, April 24th, 2020, reported by Alex Bollinger, Trump's anti-LGBTQ press secretary defends his suggestion to inject people with Lysol. When I heard this, I just went, are you kidding me? The anti-LGBTQ White House press secretary, Hayley McEnany, defended Donald Trump's suggestion that people inject themselves with bleach or disinfectant to cure COVID-19, lashing out at the media for taking his comments out of context. At a very recent White House coronavirus task force briefing, an official discussed research that showed that disinfectants like isopropyl alcohol, UV light, and bleach could kill the virus within minutes. Donald Trump went into super sleuth mode, commenting that a tremendous ultraviolet or just very powerful light on or inside the body could be a treatment for coronavirus. And then he brought up chemical disinfectants. And then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute. 1 minute, he said. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning? I'm not a doctor, but I'm like a person that has a good you-know-what, pointing to his head, because you see it gets in the lungs and does a tremendous number on them, so it'd be interesting to check that. His comments got immediate blowback from public health officials, and a video close-up of Dr. Deborah Brix, seated off to the side of the president as he spoke, shows a visibly shocked and undeniably uncomfortable Dr. Brix reacting to his comments. I think we need to speak very clearly that there's no circumstance under which you should take a disinfectant or inject a disinfectant for the treatment of anything, and certainly not for the treatment of coronavirus, said former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb, who added that disinfectants can kill if ingested. The company that produces the disinfectant Lysol, which contains isopropyl alcohol, issued a statement as well, saying that people should not drink or inject their product, citing recent speculation and social media activity. Now, we must be clear that under no circumstance should our disinfectant products be administered into the human body through injection, ingestion, or any other route. As with all products, our disinfectant and hygiene products should only be used as intended and in line with usage guidelines. Please read the label and safety information. Now, instead of simply admitting that he had made a mistake and apologizing, the new White House press secretary defended Trump's comments, blaming the media for irresponsibly taking them out of context. Also from LGBTQ Nation, Friday, April 24th, 2020, reported by Alex Bollinger, Trump administration moves to allow doctors to refuse trans patients as COVID rages. This administration has targeted our trans community from day one. The new rule would roll back Obama-era protections that banned discrimination against transgender people at the worst time possible. Now, as the U.S. passes 50,000 deaths from the COVID-19 pandemic, the Trump administration quietly moved forward with a rule that would make it easier for doctors to refuse to treat transgender patients. Political reports that a new Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, rule that would remove Obama-era transgender protections was circulated around the Department of Justice recently, one of the final steps before publicly releasing the rule. The White House also updated a website to say that the Obama rule is under review, which is just code for, we're gonna revoke it, y'all. At issue is Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. The rule bans discrimination on the basis of sex in healthcare, which the Obama administration interpreted as banning discrimination against transgender people, since discriminating against someone because their gender identity doesn't align with their sex assigned at birth is effectively discriminating against them because of sex. The Trump administration has consistently said that protections on the basis of sex do not apply to anti-transgender discrimination, and HHS, which has been working on the new rule for over a year, said that the rule change would make its regulations more consistent. LGBTQ equality advocates said that the change would allow hospitals and healthcare workers to discriminate legally. If the final rule is anything like the proposed rule, HHS is adopting changes that would be harmful in the best of times, but that are especially cruel in the midst of a global pandemic that is disproportionately affecting vulnerable communities and exacerbating disparities, according to Georgetown University professor Katie Keith. Discrimination against transgender people is rampant in healthcare. The Center for American Progress, CAP, found that 29% of transgender adults said that a healthcare professional refused to see them because of their gender identity. LGBTQ people are 7 times more likely to say they have avoided going to the doctor out of fear of discrimination, a phenomenon that advocates warn could be deadly during the coronavirus pandemic. An HHS spokesperson said, "We do not comment on the rulemaking process," and referred questions to the HHS Office of Civil Rights, which is run by Roger Severino, a former Heritage Foundation staffer who has a long history of anti-LGBTQ activism and was called the most dangerous person to head up the Office of Civil Rights at HHS, according to the Human Rights Campaign. From Alt News, NBCNews.com, April 24th, 2020, reported by Nico Lang. Ex-cop gets $90,000 settlement in HIV employment discrimination suit. A former police officer received $90,000 in damages after filing a lawsuit claiming he was denied employment as a sheriff's deputy in 2012 when his prospective employer learned he has HIV. A lawsuit filed by Lambda Legal in the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Louisiana said the former officer, Liam Pierce, was up for a job with the Iberia Parish Sheriff's Office in New Iberia until he disclosed his status during a pre-employment medical exam. According to the LGBTQ legal advocacy group, Pierce had experience working as a police officer, volunteer firefighter, and paramedic. Scott Schoetz, an attorney for Lambda Legal and the director of its HIV project, said everything seemed perfectly on track for Pierce to land the job. He had good interviews and talked to them about an alleged misconduct at a previous job. They said that wasn't a problem. Attorney Schoetz said everything changed, though, when Pierce informed the medical team evaluating him for employment about his HIV status. He alleged the plaintiff was told by doctors that having HIV was not a disqualification for the job, but shortly after his results were sent to the sheriff's office, Pierce was denied the position. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission found in 2018 that Pierce had probable cause to bring legal action regarding his claim, and he settled out of court recently. As a condition of the settlement, the department staff will undergo education and training regarding HIV, and the office's hiring guidelines will include a statement that discrimination on the basis of disability, including HIV status, is prohibited. Pierce said in a statement that it feels good to finally be vindicated 8 years after his case was initially filed. I hope that my case helps others avoid going through my experience. From Advocate.com, April 24th, 2020, reported by Trudy Ring, Day of Silence goes virtual but stays visible. A day to observe silence and eventually to break it may be just what a lot of LGBTQ young people sheltering at home need. Some may not feel free to be their authentic selves at home, and even those who do are likely feeling the loss of the community they had at school, with gay-straight alliances and other groups, says Soli Guzman, a student organizer for GLSEN's Day of Silence. GLSEN, formerly the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network, is a United States-based education organization working to end discrimination, harassment, and bullying based on sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender expression, and to prompt LGBT cultural inclusion and awareness in K-12 schools. Not having that community right now has been very difficult, said Guzman, a senior at the Athenian School in Danville, California, and member of GLSEN's National Student Council. And that's all the more reason to participate in the Day of Silence that occurred on Friday, April 24th, a virtual rally to break the silence streamed on Facebook Live. That was the 25th anniversary of the Day of Silence, in which LGBTQ students and allies stay silent in their schools to call attention to the silence and erasure of LGBTQ youth. Now that the vast majority of students aren't in school, they observed silence at home, if possible, joined the virtual event, and engaged in other forms of advocacy. And that's the honest tea. It's been a crappy week. So now here's 90 seconds of mood-lifting comic relief with the song stylings of IMRU executive producer Steve Pride and the humor of the Nellie Olson's improv team.
Come on, come on, come on, come on, I'm a comedian. I tell a joke, I tell a joke.
Hi, we're the Nellie Olsons. I'm Nora Burns.
I'm Terrence Michael.
I'm John Cantwell.
And I'm Marissa Copeland.
If you're looking for a codependent lesbian relationship with a needy woman, call me. I'm waiting. I'll move in with you. I'll become allergic to your cats, and when you give them away, I'll break up with you. Is that how you like it? Oh, call me. I'll wear your clothes. We'll go get counseling together and adopt a Nicaraguan crack baby, and then I'll sleep with all your friends. Is that how you like it? Oh, call me. Oh, Mama, you're so good to me. I'll stalk you till you take out a restraining order on me. Is that how you like it? Oh, call me. I've got some hot, steamy issues for you. We'll process everything. I'll make your life hell. Call me. Oh, yeah.
Hey, everybody, it's Boy Shecky. Wow, what an attractive crowd. Everyone here is so good looking. I mean it. Everyone's so good. Whoa, thank you, sir, for breaking the monotony. Excuse me, is this your wife? Hey, baby doll, want to carry my child? Just to the corner, it can take the bus from there. I've got an American flag tattooed on my chest. Flagpole's a little further down. Seriously, dog face, you wanna play doctor? You can be the receptionist. Wait, don't leave, I got a million of them!
Comedy kudos to my executive producer, Steve Pride, and the humor of the wonderful Nellie Olson's improv team. I don't know about you, but I think I could use that comic relief every single day. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this quick break.
Top Native American poet, Maurice Kenney, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Maurice Kenney was born in upstate New York in 1929, his father a Mohawk Indian and his mother part Seneca. As a teenager, he began writing poetry, and at 17, he closely identified with the works of Walt Whitman. Kenney issued his first poetry collection at 28. About 10 years later, in the late 1960s, he wrote First Rule, which marked a return to the oral traditions of his native heritage. During the 1970s, he published two collections that reflected his consciousness of his native cultural heritage, and in other works, he claimed his gay identity. In 1987, Kenney was again focused on Walt Whitman, but not as a hero. He wrote a critique titled, Whitman's Indifference to Indians, in which he condemned Whitman's silence on U.S. Native American policies. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and recorded at WRAR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Andrew Cawthorn.
Hello, I'm Jerry Jewell, Cousin Jerry from Facts of Life and Jewell from Deadwood, and the author of I'm Walking As Straight As I Can. And you are listening to IMRU Radio Magazine.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Rod McEwen was a singer, songwriter, and actor. He was one of the best-selling poets in the United States during the late 1960s. He wrote over 100 songs and was nominated for an Oscar in 1969 for Jean, from the prime of Miss Jean Brodey. To celebrate his birthday on April 29th, we're rerunning an interview with Rod McEwen from 2001. For reasons still not entirely clear, our executive producer, Steve Pride, was invited as a guest to his 67th birthday party. Luckily, he took a recorder. But locating McEwen among the celebrity guests was not as easy as he'd thought.
In 1950, Rod McEwen coined the phrase, "Make love, not war," and it became a rallying cry for both the Korean and Vietnam conflicts. So it is oddly serendipitous that on the night another war is launched, I find myself attending a party for McEwen. Just as our interview was to begin, McEwen has been whisked back outside to face the paparazzi. But the night is young, and there's a handsome man at the bar.
Harry Hamlin. Well, I tell you, you know, when I was in college and before, Rod McEwen was my hero, and still is, but he set the tone for much of my formative years. Absolutely.
My name is Dom DeLuise, and I'm here with my son, Michael. Obviously, a lot of people have a giant amount of respect for Rod McEwen. He is the best, and we need more people like him now that the world is in such turmoil. The fact that we have a man who believes that tenderness is the way to live instead of what's going on today. I mean, it really is so scary. As we drove down here, we were very aware that the war was imminent.
I'm with Buddy Hackett. With everything that's going on right now, is this the perfect time for the return of Rod McEwen to the concert stage?
This I can't tell you. I know what we think is going on in the world goes on all the time. It's just closer to home this time. But if we take the time to think of the people starving and the fact that China now has more than 1 million cases of AIDS when last year they only had 100,000, it's just, if you don't write a little poetry and if you don't tell a few jokes, the thought of it's going to kill you.
Phyllis Diller is not just a fan of Rod McEwen, she's a good friend.
We've known each other for 50 years. When he was 18 years old, he was working at a radio station in the Bay Area where he had this very successful show. He was writing poetry and he wrote every week, he wrote a whole new show. And I fell in love with him then and I've been in love with him ever since.
This is This Way Out, which is a gay and lesbian show. Do you have a shout out to any of your gay and lesbian fans out there?
Well, yes. Live the great life and have a lot of fun.
Hi, this is Red Buttons. What did you want to know?
Rod McEwen. Why are you a fan of Rod McEwen?
I never heard of Rod McEwen. I just saw people coming to a party and I just jumped in.
And you are?
Sally Kirkland.
I've heard of you.
Well, I hope so. 91 movies. Okay.
We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun.
We had, go on. Da 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 da. Tom! What are the rest of the words?
We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun.
Okay, in French.
Je m'appelle ton.
I am finally back with Rod McEwen. Rod, where have you been? And I don't mean tonight. I mean, you've been out of the public eye for a long time.
I have. I went through a clinical depression, and they don't know how to diagnose that. And so it was, in a way, it was kind of up to me. One morning I woke up and said to myself, what the hell do you have to be depressed about? And the answer was nothing. And so I got over it. That's about it. Well, it took me 10 years.
I grew up in Florida in the 1970s, and as I recall, you were one of the loudest voices raised against Anita Bryant and her Save the Children campaign.
Don't drink the orange juice, I beg you please, don't drink the orange juice. Yeah, that was a long time ago. I don't like anyone who's against human rights, and I just felt what she was saying, the fact that nobody was replying to it and nobody was challenging her was wrong. And so I'm a friend of anyone who's struggling for human rights.
That reminds me, you are also famous for a somewhat melancholy, but a really poignant song about being gay in the 1960s called The Ballad of the Sad Young Men.
I wish I'd written that. I didn't. I was the first person to record it, but that was written by Fran Lansman and Tommy Wolf. They wrote it years before, but it wound up in a Broadway show that was called The Nervous Set, and they sent it to me, and I recorded it. I recorded it a couple times, and I love that song.
What do you think of the strides we've made in terms of gay rights?
Well, I think gay rights have made some progress, not enough, but I think it's like anything else. It's slow. I don't think blacks have made the kind of progress they should. I don't think women have made the kind of progress. I led the first Women's Liberation Day parade in Sydney, Australia. And those are, civil rights are really important to me. I'm going to be 70 next month, and I've been blessed with a wonderful life, and I've come up at a time when all kinds of changes were going on. I know that the kids of today are impatient. They have a right to be, but it'll all work out in the end. I think it will, because we're all human beings, nothing more, nothing less. We're not angels, we're not desperados, we're human beings. We're not straight, we're not gay, we're not women, we're not men, we're people, we're human beings who need to be accorded the same rights and privileges as every other human being on the face of the earth. I'm surprised that so many of my old friends have come out on a night like this when I guess war has started. And I worry about us, you know, the old men of this country, sending our children off to fight in battles. I don't want anyone to die on my behalf. I'm capable of doing that myself when the time comes.
Mr. McEwen, could I talk you into doing a reading of my favorite poem, Creed?
I can almost read it from memory, but not quite. I'm putting on my glasses. Doesn't matter who you love or how you love, but that you love. For in the end, the act of loving any man is the act of loving God. The good in men is all the God there is. And loving is a contribution to that good and to that only God. And I believe that with my heart.
There were a few questions I had that remain unanswered. I'm not sure if Rod McEwen is gay, straight, or bisexual. I'm also not sure that it matters. I am sure he is a good friend to our community, and his emergence from retirement returns a much-needed voice to the world stage. For his is a special gift that puts into words and music what we all are thinking and hoping and dreaming. Rod McEwen's Prime of Your Life concert tour begins April 30th at Carnegie Hall and will be followed by free events throughout the United States aimed at senior citizens. For more information, visit Rod's website at www.mcewen.com. This is Steve Pride in Hollywood. Thanks for listening.
I go to Florida a lot because the weather's always hot. There's pretty girls and pretty boys, as many Jews as there are goys, as many blacks as there are whites, as many days as there are nights, as many straights as there are gay. Yes, they have fun in lots of ways. Ah, but don't drink the orange juice,
I beg you please.
Don't drink the orange juice,
I beg you please.
Don't drink the orange juice,
I beg you please.
Might lead to all kinds of bigotry. Miami Beach is pretty sand, as nice as lovely summer can. The Cuban music is the top at all the discotheques and hops. There's Hetty sailing in the Keys, and all the sharks are out to sea. Yes, Florida's a place to be, but won't you take a tip from me? Oh,
don't drink the orange juice, don't drink the orange juice, I beg you. Don't drink the orange juice, I beg you.
My beliefs are lots of kinds of bigotry.
Since that party, we've lost Buddy Hackett in 2003, Red Buttons in 2006, Dom DeLuise in 2009, stand-up comedian pioneer Phyllis Diller in 2012, and Rod McEwen himself in 2015. Back to keeping it light. Well Strung is a muscular gay male string quartet based in New York City. Let's take a listen to their music and origin story.
Hey, I'm Chris Marchant.
I'm Daniel Shevlin.
Hi, this is Trevor Wadley.
Hello, I'm Edmund Bagnell.
And we are Well Strung.
I'm Edmund, and I'm first violinist. My grandparents bought a violin for me, but it was kind of silly because they got a full-size violin, whereas normally kids get, you know, half-size, quarter-size. I definitely needed a quarter-size because I was six when I started. But my parents liked the idea, so they got me violin lessons and a new properly-sized violin, and I've been playing ever since.
I'm Chris. I'm the second violinist. When I was a kid, my mom told me that I had to do something, like some kind of activity, and I was terrible at t-ball. I couldn't even hit the stationary ball off the tee. So I quit that and started playing violin instead.
This is Trevor. I play viola. In fifth grade, I started in a public school program. I started on violin. I didn't really have anyone in my family or community that I knew whom played. I don't know. It was something that was foreign to me, and I wanted to figure it out and see what it was all about, so I started.
I'm Daniel, and I'm the cellist. For me, it was probably third grade. Sort of an activities coordinator just came around to our schools, and anyone who wanted to play a stringed instrument could sign up. And at the time, I actually signed up to play violin. And so I played violin for about a year, but then my string teacher, she actually needed more cellos. And so I guess I was just more drawn to the sound of a cello because I was just decided to switch then and there. And so that's how I started playing the cello.
Since you've been gone, I can't breathe for the first time. I'm so moving on, yeah, yeah. Thanks to you, now I get. You should know that I get what I want. Since you've been gone.
I was doing another show in Provincetown in 2010. And I would play a violin on the street to make extra money. And a theater producer in town, Mark Cortali, approached me and we started collaborating on a project because he knew that I sang as well. So we just started tossing ideas around and came up with putting a spin on the standard string quartet. I found Daniel through a mutual friend on Facebook and I just sent him a message. He was living in Denver at the time and I was like, hey, you should move back to New York and do this instead. So he eventually did, and then right after that happened, Edmund and Trevor showed up to our auditions.
The reaction's been fantastic. I think the most common reaction, I would say, in a way, is surprise. We get a lot of people who are like, well, I saw this advertisement for the show, and I thought it was going to be kind of good for a few laughs. And then after the show, they're like, wow, you guys really impressed me. So I think people kind of don't know what to expect with us. I think what you were saying earlier about what is our genre, I don't think we actually neatly fit into one genre, and I think that's why people don't know what to expect with us. But we're pioneering the way, right? Yeah.
We got our start in Provincetown. That's where most people heard about us for the first time, and they have Naked Boy singing up there and a couple other nude shows. So people, I think, just assumed that that's what we did. But no, not the case.
We just were trying to have a witty name.
Yeah.
A little cheeky.
Cheeky.
The other misconception, I think also based on the name, is that we don't actually play very well, or that it's a gimmick and we just like made up a funny show and are pretending to play violin or something. I think a few people that we've come across have had that perception of us, and then they come away realizing that we are real full-time musicians.
We tend to gravitate towards pop music because if you think about classical music of the time, it was popular music of its time.
Right. All music was new at one time.
Yeah. And so I think there's some subtle beauty in trying to combine both of them. And at the same time, kind of keeping true to the roots of a string quartet while doing this new thing with singing and playing at the same time. And
there are no other singing string quartets, so we're kind of making it up as we go.
We could have had it all. Played it, you played it.
starting Provincetown, you know, that brings a certain audience with it, just inherent to who goes there in the summer. But as we've been touring around the country, our audience has definitely been more mixed. A lot of teenagers, actually, which is
and
cool.
Kids.
Yeah, kids, families. What is so cool about what we do is that we appeal to a truly broad range of people. We'll have kids and then like 80-year-olds in our audience, and everybody seems to leave having a really great time. And I think that's pretty special, you know, creating a cool night out for a wide variety of people.
We just happen to all be gay. It wasn't the point of the show at all. It just happens to be that way, and it's not something we focus on in the show. It's just a fact.
Well, also, and we were also created, not created in P-Town, but, you know, a lot of where we got all of our grounding was in P-Town, and obviously it's a predominantly gay audience. So in order to get a good jump, I'm sure a lot of our content in our first show was a little bit more gay-centric. And there's still moments, but it was never intended to be like a gay show or a, you know, it's just part of who we are, but it's not what defines us, I don't think. I think our music should be what defines us.
So, so what? I'm still a rock star. I got my rock moves and I don't need you. And guess what? I'm having more fun, and now that we're done, I'm gonna show you tonight. I'm alright, I'm just fine, and you're a tool, so, so what? I'm still a rock star, I got my rock moves, and I don't want you tonight.
All of Wellstrung's music is available on iTunes or Amazon. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Maurice Kenney's Many Pieces, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Maurice Kenney combines an American Indian and gay consciousness to create pieces that connect to multiple cultures. Kenney's earliest interest in poetry began as a teenager when his interest in the poetry of Walt Whitman guided his own writings that drew upon American Indian oral traditions and cultures. After university studies, Kenney issued his first poetry collection at age 28. Preferring to call his works pieces, he claimed his gay identity in 1976 with Tinseled Books, an historical study in Indian homosexuality, as well as with the poem Winkti. Kenney's pieces have been published in countless collections of poetry, fiction, and essays in nearly 100 journals in many languages. They've also been included in TV, radio, and film productions. Undoubtedly, he ranks among the top American Indian writers. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Orangina.
Hello, I'm Billy Bean, Major League Baseball's Ambassador for Inclusion, and you are listening to IMRU Radio Magazine.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Taylor Gray. There is no concert tour more iconic than the Blonde Ambition Tour. Along with the documentary Truth or Dare and Madonna's world-class dancers with their work in the Vogue video and their appearance on the 1990 MTV Video Music Awards, defined the early 90s. Last year, Wenzel Jones and Abby Dees sat down with all the dancers and backup singers to talk about their adventures with Madonna and the documentary about them, Strike a Pose.
Hello, I am Carlton Wilborn, and I'm one of the dancers from the Blonde Ambition Tour.
I'm Kevin Stay, and I'm also one of the dancers from the Blonde Ambition Tour, also dance captain and associate choreographer.
Hi guys, my name is Luis Camacho. I'm also one of the dancers of the Blonde Ambition Tour and co-choreographer of the Vogue video.
Hi, my name is Donna DeLore, and I sang and danced on that Blonde Ambition Tour.
Hi, I'm Nikki Harris, and I'm one of the singers, dancers, and all-around pain in the butt on the Blonde Ambition Tour.
Yes, and spiritual goddess.
And spiritual goddess, yes.
The question I have for the women specifically is the Blonde Ambition Tour was so much a gay thing. You were surrounded by these gay male dancers, and they were orbiting around a gay male icon. Where was your place in that universe, and how did you assert yourself?
I felt very comfortable. I didn't feel like I really had to assert myself. Nikki and I had started working with Madonna in 1987, so we'd already been on one round of Camp Madonna, and we'd already done our first tour being very young.
Yeah. Actually, the gay thing for me, also because we were dancers, too. We had been around dancers, so
that's
being,
another thing.
You know, that was not a big deal
I
for
grew
us.
Up.
What was a big deal is that we were in a much more quieter way of living as far as our lifestyle. So this was the first time that we were around dancers who were definitely saying, Louis gave me my first fragrance. Kevin gave me my first... Tell your boyfriend that. Actually, he was the first time that a man came to me and said, I know you like me, but I'm gay. So I was like...
I was completely in love with Slam. Yeah. I mean, the moment he walked in,
everybody,
but I was just like, he was just the most beautiful.
And he is still beautiful. He's just not here today.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Everyone in this room is beautiful, I have to say.
Everybody got better.
Yeah. That's one huge perception from the film, is how interested I am in all of you.
When I watched the film, I was really struck by how confident all of you looked way back when, 25 years, I can't believe it. I'm a singer, and seeing you just grabbing it as singers and seeing you guys grabbing it as men, as these dancers. And then when I saw the film, I saw what vulnerable kids you were. And you even described yourselves that way a little bit, and Madonna was sort of this mom figure. Did you have any idea at the time how people were viewing you or what it meant to people to view you?
Not at all. There was no social media for us to have sort of an immediate feedback of,
right.
of people's response. So we just did our show and then we rushed off to the next city. So there really wasn't this sense of a response of understanding how we were landing with people other than the regular fans would just come and scream. So we didn't really have an understanding of anything of
depth. I mean, at the venues when the shows were happening or when we went in to do our sound check because they would allow some of the audience to come in early, and, you know, that sort of ramp up in their energy, we could tell. And Louis says it in the film that they would be screaming out all of our names, mm-hmm. you know, or we'd see a banner with Donna and mm-hmm. Kevin and Nikki and everybody. So we could see it like that, but to be aware of it after the job was over, not so much.
And it seems like the impact is something that's continued. Like the bigger impact is really not just the show and the entertainment value of the show, but sort of the impact on how people felt freer to express themselves over time. Mm-hmm.
And speaking of the impact that has continued, when I was watching the flashbacks to Truth or Dare, which I haven't seen since it came out, it looked as if you guys were softening the ground for the tidal wave of reality programming that we're now mm-hmm. swimming in. Because that was the first time when I look back and you think, oh, that's when we got used to cameras just being up in everybody's face in bed and doing what people do. I mean, of course, you couldn't have known it at the time, but how does it feel to look back and think, wow, I was there at the birth practically?
Well, to be clear, there are a lot of concert movies. I think this film was the first in that it kind of delved more into...
sex, I think, is the word we're looking for.
Or that.
Social
but
issues.
And into the lives, into our lives. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't just a concert movie. It was really a documentary into... backstage.
And also her willingness to be exposed and to share herself behind the scenes, looking bad or being bitchy or whatever it was that she was sharing. Like, that's unheard of. The stars are very careful with their images and they give forth a very, you know, carved little presence. And she was just much more open and free like that. Her view is what created this whole sense of reality TV.
And as we all wonder now when we watch reality TV, how much of it was scripted or was it truly reality that far back?
Well, I mean, you know, all of that is subject because to some degree, once I say, can you guys sit over here or come and stand over there and
come
let's
back in
light,
again, yeah, do that again.
No, it ain't organically real. Every reality project that we witness is sculpted to some degree.
I think what happened was as we were on tour, things would happen like... we started on our own with a film crew playing Truth or Dare at dinners.
Oh, yeah.
In Spain with drinking sangria playing Truth
That's
or
right.
Dare. And then it got around, you know, I'm sure Al
totally.
Heard about it. And he was like, ooh, let's
That's
do that with Madonna at dinner. Yeah. So things were organically happening between us.
Yeah.
And then it would it would spark an idea to have right. that be a yeah. scene, and then we were all at a dinner and we all played together, and then things spontaneously obviously happened.
And Donna and Nikki, you had been doing this with Madonna for a while. This was not new to you. This was new in many ways to you guys and the other four dancers. This exposure to that level of fame and the Madonna frenzy that happened in the film Strike a Pose really goes into sort of the unexpected effects of that on you guys. But did you sort of look at them and kind of go, oh, we've been down this road, we know a little bit about what to expect?
I know that I didn't. I knew I was older than them, but I was young enough that we had seen Madonna turn into a pop star, so we had got to that part. And we knew by this tour that she was a bona fide superstar. We knew that. We also, well, you know, we got to go through Sean with her. We got to go through the entrance of Warren Beatty. We had done soundtracks with her. We've done albums.
Worship.
So all kind of stuff like that. But what we did not get to do is see her really put her life around her dancers the way she had done with them. And then you throw on top of that putting a camera around it all, too. So I think Warren said it best. This is really what you really want to do. Who would think somebody would want to have a camera follow?
Right. Well,
apparently everybody.
Apparently everyone. and maybe. I mean, and I guess that is still the $6,000 question. Really? Does everybody want it? I don't know if everybody wants it, because some people still find it really hard to tell the truth, especially on camera. Especially on camera. That's what this movie shows. Because there's some unsaids in this movie that are said very loudly.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Of course, we were young like you guys, and that was probably my favorite tour ever. But the one thing I did notice was you guys had endless amounts of energy to go out after the show. Nikki and I
we always take a nap.
We'd been meeting for like a tea or something. And there you guys are after the show, dressed up in these clothes. It was inspiring. And then we'd be like, we got to go out too. Come on.
To the crack of dawn.
Let's go. And you always knew where you were going.
Oh, that was crazy.
So
and these were the first people made me feel like I didn't know nothing. I was so green. Like, are you really going to wear that? You know you really could put some fragrance on. You know you really, are you really going to wear your hair like that? And I'm like, I felt bad. Like, I'm older, but yet they're telling, I'm like, I guess I'm not. I'm not wearing these earrings with this.
Yeah.
And how do you know where to go in Tel Aviv?
Exactly.
I don't know where to go in Chicago. You know where to go in Tel Aviv?
There is a secret gay network that preceded the internet, and it's a boy gay
absolutely.
Network, and
absolutely.
It still exists.
I want to hear about it. I never had a membership to it. No, really, how did you know where to go in Tel Aviv?
I'm not even really sure. It was always just
where
a matter.
Where did you go in Tel Aviv? For that
we didn't. On this one, we didn't go to Tel Aviv, but certainly like Spain and Madrid and like and like Amsterdam. I think people came to us. Come out to this club
yeah,
tonight. And we're like,
totally
okay,
cool.
I heard that there's a something, and we're all gonna go. And then once we all decided on that, then we're our own party. We can go anywhere.
Well, there was always that one person that stayed behind that followed us to the hotel, hung out in the lobby,
that would invite us.
And they would talk us up and invite us somewhere. And we were like, sure, let's go.
Yeah. As well as it's hard to sleep when there's thousands of people down at the bottom of your hotel.
Oh,
going,
yeah.
Ma, Madonna. We might as well go out, because we're not going to sleep.
Plus, we were so high from the adrenaline, you know.
Just a reminder, I'm Abby Dees.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
And we're in a studio filled with folks from Madonna's 1990 Blonde Ambition Tour, talking about that tour, their lives, Madonna, the 1991 film Truth or Dare, and the 2017 documentary Strike a Pose. Let me ask you a little bit about somebody who is not in the film today and apparently loved by everyone, was Gabriel. And Gabriel passed away from HIV, and I'm just wondering if you could share some of your memories of Gabriel and what he brought to this group.
Where do we start? He was just beautiful, and it was one of those, like, not because I had that kind of crush on you. Gabriel had this, like, oh, my God, he's just so precious. Like,
I always thought of Gabriel, like, aesthetically and energetically, as like a cherub. He was just like this beautiful, delicate, but owning space thing. Yeah, he was just a gentle force.
Oliver in the film, who is the one straight fellow of the dancers, I love his story of him sort of getting over his stuff was so sweet. But he described Gabriel as innocent.
Yeah.
That sounds right.
It's not that he was innocent, but it was just that his energy about it was always so positive and bright and light and giving, and the way he moved was so beautiful. There was a beauty about him always.
He was an enigma to me and Jose.
Yeah.
Me and Jose came from the Lower East Side of New York, so
what's your
we
scam?
We didn't have a lot of friends that were like Gabriel. Yeah. I don't know. He was just so nice.
I will say this in front of my two brothers. I love y'all down. But Kevin and Gabriel were two of the first dancers that I was always going, How did they do that? They tumbled. They danced. They could do ballet. They did everything and looked effortless doing it. Just like, I was like, are they about to, he just flipped four times. He just did a flip and we got this much room. How is he doing that? Between you and Gabe, I used to just be in awe at watching you guys dance every night.
I think all of us kind of wanted to be around him a lot. I know for myself, if I ever wanted to go anywhere or I'd go have dinner or go shopping or go walking around or go explore anything, he was the first person I called. Always. Because I knew I'd have a good time. I knew it'd be relaxing. It would be fun. I knew I could share anything I wanted to with him and it would all be accepted and enjoyed.
Mm-hmm. I look to Gabriel if I ever wanted just a quiet conversation. Mm-hmm. It was Gabriel, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we had all this energy and it was like the Kiki was always with us. But if I just wanted just a respite from that, I would turn to Gabriel.
The ease.
And that's who he was for me.
One of the things that the film goes into in great detail, 3 of the 7 dancers were HIV positive. And one of the things the film talks about that is so moving to me is that none of the men that were HIV positive shared this with anybody. Everybody was quiet about it. And in many ways, Strike a Pose is a coming out story about this.
I am one of the 3. I was diagnosed in 1985. And the beauty about this project right now is it's allowing me, because I'm so on the other side of it, the it being all the shame and the just the self chastisement thing that was going on. I'm so on the other side of that. Mm-hmm. And so it's amazing right now. So that feels like the coming out. Like what's coming out is my joy of life and my freedom to be authentically me across the board.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Really beautiful.
And we've seen one of our own pass. Gabriel passed from this and didn't even share it. I asked him point blank, are you HIV positive? Do you have AIDS? He said no. Closest person to me. I'm like, couldn't even share it with me. It definitely shows how far we've come. Yeah. It shows how much progress we've made.
I remember that time being so scared. I remember one time I was dating someone and we were getting intimate. It was in the evening and somebody called me. Can you imagine answering the phone? You have a date, someone's over at your home, and they say, Donna, I just got to let you know, he's HIV positive.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you put your clothes back on and left?
We hadn't gotten, we were like just kissing and stuff, but and who knows? Maybe 10 minutes later, he's going to tell me.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But that I got that phone call, and that was the reality we were all living in. Mm. I remember going to get my own test and thinking it could be me.
Right.
And this was before the antiretrovirals. I mean, this was when HIV was pretty much a guaranteed death sentence. The question was when.
Absolutely.
It was a question of when.
Yes, yeah.
And especially if you didn't have money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Contacts.
Insurance.
And so if you were a person, especially of color, you knew it was a death sentence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What have your lives been like outside of the, traveling with HIV or the Blonde Ambition Tour? I mean, what have your lives been like outside of that? Because you've all accomplished things. They just weren't really brought up in the movie.
Yeah. I've been working as an actor from before I got the Blonde Ambition Tour. So a lot of what I do is still in that realm. I've done a slew of national commercials and films and TV shows. I have been writing and coaching and my life coaching work, which is the first ever movement based through dance life coaching program called Dance Formation. So I've been traveling around. I now do events with that and building out some other cool entertainment projects.
And Kevin?
Oh my. I don't think I've ever really stopped doing what we were doing back in the day. I landed off after tour and literally just auditioned the next day and kept going. And I've never stopped. And it's really not because I have to be a dancer forever. It was just I'm compelled to. It's such a part of me now and such a part of my expression and who I am and such an opportunity. The people that I've worked with over the past 26 years are my family. And why wouldn't I want to continue working with my family, seeing my family, hanging out with the people that I love, earning money and doing fun things in fun situations in exciting cities and exciting countries? I'm having a hard time giving it up, honestly.
Sometimes your body has other ideas, though.
Well, I did have my hip replaced last year, and I was back in class a month later.
And to see him dance, you have no freaking idea he ever had surgery.
You and Liza Minnelli.
Me
and
Liza Minnelli. Just going to say hashtag Liza Minnelli. Oh, my God.
And Lewis?
My life has been a little twisty, turny. And I don't regret any of that because it's brought me to this situation today. So, but me and Jose recorded a little album after. It wasn't really an album. It was actually three songs on a compilation album.
Which I heard a little snippet of in the film, and I thought, okay, I need to go get that and put that on my workout playlist. It sounded great.
It was fun to do. But these days, I work a lot with this charity called Aid for AIDS, the Alliance for Housing and Healing. Because this is not only a gay disease, this disease does affect women and families. Mm-hmm. So this charity Absolutely. Directly gives monies to families who are displaced due to HIV and AIDS, and it provides medication and housing for people who are affected with HIV.
Madonna.
I ended up doing 6 world tours with Madonna. And
wow. You're like the Michael Jordan of Madonna tours.
Your voice is more Madonna than Madonna.
I started making my own records in 1992, and I've been continuing on. I've made a lot of records in the yoga, world music, devotional genre, and started working with Nikki on this amazing project, which I'm so excited about.
Two friends.
So
they
I'm
just
really
released
excited.
A song.
We released a song.
Yes.
It's a cover of Rain.
Yes.
Can we hear a little bit?
What key should we do it in?
Are you serious? You really want us to sing?
I don't want you to sing.
Feel it on my fingertips. Hear it on my windowpane. Your love's coming down like rain. Wash away my sorrow. Take away my pain. Your love's coming down like rain.
What? Is that a blend or is that a blend? I mean, the whole room just lit up. Like, everything started bouncing off the walls.
I want everybody's favorite Blonde Ambition memory.
So many memories of that tour. This is Donna, by the way. Sometimes I'll be like waking up or going into a dream or something and things will pop back. Feelings of us all being out to dinner in Paris.
Yes.
The one that is really strong that I love and I think you guys can all relate to is at the very end of the tour, Madonna said to us, we're going to do the MTV Awards.
Yeah.
And the feeling that this is going to continue on, this creativity, and that we were all so sad to be saying goodbye, but we didn't have to really because we were going to be seeing each other.
Right.
And then we were all brainstorming about what the theme should be and putting in our 2 cents and being creative. And then went on shortly after that to do the performance.
Well, first of all, I'm too old to remember what I had for lunch, so I sure don't remember much about a tour that was in 1990. No, so many waves. It's waves of feeling. Mm. So the gentleness of laying in beds that we were taking naps in together. As a musician, her allowing Don and I to really have some freedom to say, let's try this, let's try the groove this way. Let's put in that, you know, the keep it together is one of my favorite parts of the show. Okay, let's try to put a little Sly in there. The band was funky. We had this amazing bass player, Daryl Jones, who's now with the Stones. We're like, let's use that. And whereas we didn't really do that in Who's That Girl, I kind of came in and we just like, here's the parts, here's the outfits, don't say nothing. This one, it was like, no, let's try it this way. So that more collaborative feeling.
Yes.
That's where I got caught up in the, like, this is really a family, right? Because we're doing this together, right? Oh, it's going in. But I think because we had that collaborative feeling on so many levels, whether it be dancing, whether it be music, whether it be singing, creating arrangements together, that somewhere in our soul, we told ourselves, she ain't saying goodbye. We ain't saying goodbye. And I think that's the part that has been really the greatest memory for me that continues to hold me up when I'm having moments. And we've all had those moments that gets to be talked about in Strike a Pose. Clearly, some people are still having the moments. But if I think it's gone, then it's gone. But it never ends. The music never dies. The dance never ends.
And that's the perfect note to end on. Thanks, Kevin, Carlton, Lewis, Nikki, and Donna for sharing your stories with us. The documentary is called Strike a Pose. For IMRU Radio, I'm Abby Dees.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
Don't go for second best, baby. Put your love to the test. You know you
Strike a Pose is available for rent or purchase on iTunes. Well, that's the end of our show. Our thanks to IMRU's executive producer Steve Boy Shecky Pride and Rainbow Minute producers Judd Proctor and Brian Burns. Find us online at imruradio.org and follow us on Facebook at IMRU Radio. If you are a web designer, social media expert, or just interested in LGBTQI community affairs and would like to volunteer with IMRU, email volunteer@imruradio.org. You can also listen to our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Breaker, Radio Public, Stitcher, Anchor.fm, CastBox, and Pocket Casts. Remember, you can help slow the spread of COVID-19 virus. If you have symptoms, call your doctor and stay home. If you don't have symptoms and you can stay home, all together again, stay home. IMRU has been here for 46 years and will continue to be here to keep you company. Let's be alone together. Remember, an informed community is a strong community. We close with a song parody I wrote about the man in the White House. Good night and stay well. Ain't no sunshine when he's on. There's no hope when he's in the way. Ain't no sunshine when he's on. And when he's on, he talks too long. Donald Trump, just go away. It's a wonder how we stay strong. Wonder what lies he'll tell today. There ain't no sunshine when he's on. Knock, knock, but no one's home. How I wish he'd go away. And I know, 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 I know. Hey Trump, you ought to leave us alone. 'Cause ain't no sunshine when you're on. There ain't no sunshine when you're on. Darkness each and every day. There ain't no sunshine when you're on. The White House seems so far gone. Donald Trump, just go away. Donald Trump, just go away. How I wish you'd go away. Donald Trump, resign today. Just go away.